the San Francisco Experience podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy, independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 23, Episode 20, Stanford Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative, talking with Professor Emeritus Jerry Porras. Our guest today is Jerry Porras, the faculty co-director of the Latino Entrepreneurship Program at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. He's the Lane Professor of Organizational Behavior and Change Emeritus. His research interests include the characteristics of visionary companies in both the United States and Europe, the dynamics of organizational change, and leadership. In 1994, he co-authored the bestseller with Jim Collins, Built to Last. He received his BSEE at Texas Western College, MBA from Cornell, and PhD from UCLA. He joined the Stanford faculty in 1972. Jerry joins us from his office in Palo Alto. Hello, Jerry, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Jerry, please take a few moments to tell us about your career at the Stanford Graduate School of Business.
Sure. Well, as you said, I arrived at Stanford in 1972. I was a fresh PhD from UCLA. This was my first academic appointment. I started out teaching a couple of courses. One was in organization development and change, which had been the topic of my dissertation and my interest. And the second one was a course called Interpersonal Dynamics, which the students lovingly called Touchy-Feely, which was a course that was trying to help managers as leaders to really understand much more clearly the impact of their behavior on other people, since they were supposed to be getting things done through other people. And most of us aren't as aware of what the impact is of our actions and our words as we'd like to be. And so this course offered students the opportunity to learn that, helping each other to do that. And it was an exciting course, took a lot of energy, and I loved it. My research was in organizational change, and so I studied companies and how they change and what sorts of interventions into companies are effective in getting them to become more efficient, more effective, and also be better places for individuals to work in. So that was a general thrust of my research for quite a few years. My teaching generally revolved around those two topics, as I said, for several years. Back in the late 80s, I got interested in the Stanford Athletics Program because coaches would bring prospective student athletes to my office to talk about careers in business. And the Stanford doesn't have an undergraduate business school, so it was competing with schools that did have undergraduate programs in business. And those were business majors were very popular with student athletes at the time. And so we had to figure out what could we tell them about coming to Stanford. So they would bring their athletes that were trying to recruit to me, and I would chat with them and with their parents about how you could get business education here at Stanford without getting a business degree. And so that was got me connected to the athletics. And then in the late 80s, I became the Stanford faculty athletics representative, which was an interesting and exciting job for me, in addition to my regular faculty work on teaching and research. One of the reasons I loved the athletics so much was because the athletic program and the coaches and the people who ran it would make decisions fairly quickly and then go about implementing them. Mm-hmm. In contrast, academics like to talk about decisions and talk about them and make a decision and come back and remake it. And so the action's a lot slower. Yes. So it was really fun to be around people who got things done pretty quickly. I enjoyed that and did that for like 16 years until I retired from Stanford, from active duty at Stanford. I live on the campus, which is great. My commute is about 7 minutes from my house to the business school. Uh-huh. I've enjoyed that. I continue connections with the business school, as you've heard from my involvement with the Stanford Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative. But I still love Stanford sports. A little down right now about the football program and the breakup of the Pac-12. Mm-hmm. But other than that, those interests are still there for me.
What a fantastic, wide-ranging career. And how did the Latino Entrepreneurship Program come about?
From the first day that I arrived at Stanford until I left, one of my involvements was with one of my student involvements with was with the Hispanic Business Students Association, which was a group of Hispanic students who had formed this organization, and I was more or less their faculty sponsor. When I arrived at Stanford, the number of, I'll use the word Latino to describe our students because it was a lot of different terms have been used in the past, but we'll use Latino. That there were a small number of Latinos when I arrived. The first group of identifiable group of Latinos was five students who arrived in 70 and graduated in 72, the year that I arrived. Mm-hmm. Shortly thereafter, the number started to slowly increase. And when it got to be large enough, they organized themselves as an association, one of the student groups. And since I was the only Latino faculty member in the business school, they talked to me about my interest in sort of sponsoring them and guiding them. And so I did, and I basically did that for my whole career at Stanford. That was all on the student side, kind of the educational side, if mm-hmm. you will. My research never touched Latinos or sort of any ethnic group in terms of organizational change. And the reason was because at the time, the academic world did not value research that focused on any ethnic group. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of a kiss of death if you tried to do that type of research in my early career and mid-career, too. It wasn't until the very last part of my career that more and more stuff started happening in that area and was legitimized as being important to do academically. Mm-hmm. So I didn't do any research with Latinos, but was involved with Latinos in the student group and also with Latino issues throughout the university, primarily the hiring of Latino faculty into the university because the numbers were quite small and we wanted to increase numbers because the numbers of students was increasing at the time. Mm-hmm. So when I became an emeritus professor, I was initially still doing a lot of traveling, talking to audiences, business audiences about Built to Last.
Yes.
Even though Built to Last came out in 94 and I became an emeritus in 2001, mm-hmm. the demand, not only in the U.S., but worldwide for presentations around the book was still quite high. And so I did a lot of traveling for probably the first 5 to 7 years after I retired. Mm-hmm. But then that started to peter out and I started to get tired of doing it. Back in like 2012, I was at a dinner that had been organized, a yearly dinner that had been organized by the Hispanic Business Students Association to honor a Latino alum of the school and to honor him. There was a different person selected every year. So it brought back a lot of the alums, and I sat with a small group of five of them during one of those weekends when that dinner was held. And they were all kind of in their mid-career. They had all been given this award years before. And they were in the stages of saying, hey, you know, we've advanced pretty far in our companies, in our careers. We're pretty settled economically. It's really time for us to start to reflect and look back at what we're contributing to the world and specifically to the world of Latinos. Mm-hmm. So out of those conversations of looking to how we could contribute, came the idea that the mass of the number of Latinos in this country, the number is substantial now. Mm-hmm. It's about 19% of the population, which is roughly about 65 million Latinos in the U.S. Mm-hmm. today. And that population is going to continue to grow. The demographics just drive things. And by 2050 or so, there should be roughly 100 million Latinos, which would be about close to 30% of the population. Mm-hmm. That reality started us to really focus on the notion that the future economic success and health of this country, the future economic health of this country, is going to a large degree be driven by Latinos.
Yes.
Because this substantial portion of the population will do a lot to impact what the entire economic situation is for the country. And at present, the Latino population was not at a place where they were contributing much more than their subsistence level. Mm-hmm. The economy, to a large degree, 65 to 70% of the economy is driven by consumption.
Yes.
And if you have 30%, we're sort of in the future, if you have 30% of the population is only contributing at roughly a little bit above the subsistence level, then what's going to happen to the economy? You know, the economy can more or less tolerate it when we're 15, maybe 17%, mm-hmm. But when you're 30%, it can have a very negative impact. Mm-hmm. On the economy. But even at 18%, it's substantial.
Yes.
People probably haven't heard this fact, but if Latinos were a country all of their own, it would be the fifth largest economy in the world.
That's amazing.
Fifth largest. Ahead of it would be the U.S., China, Japan, and Germany. And below it would be the U.K., India, France, Italy, Canada, and Korea.
Amazing.
So that's a 2020. Mm-hmm. And just interestingly enough, when you start looking at the growth of the economies, U.S. Latinos would be third in the world behind China and India in terms of growth rate. So this is a big opportunity for the country economically, but it's also a big risk. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't grow in its economic strength beyond what it is, then the whole economy of the country will be hurting. Mm-hmm. So as we zeroed in on that idea, we said, well, we've got to do something. If we want to contribute and give back, we've got to do something to try to change that equation for the longer term future. Mm-hmm. And out of that discussion then came the idea that the key ingredient that is missing in Latino communities that would allow them to grow economically and make bigger, more significant contributions is wealth.
Yes.
And when you look at the wealth that's located in Latino communities, you know, the average level of wealth of a Latino is substantially lower than the average level of wealth of a white person in this country. Mm-hmm. And that gap is pretty significant. So we said, well, if we could do something to increase the level of wealth in Latino communities, we could have a really big impact on this longer term future. Mm-hmm. So the notion then of increasing the wealth, we said, well, how do you do that? Well, a lot of things are going on right now to try to do that. I mean, there are educational programs to try to help kids, Latino kids, graduate from high school and go to college and get degrees. Mm-hmm. There are programs that try to improve the health and well-being of the communities. There are training programs of various sorts. There are programs to try to clean up neighborhoods and stuff like that. So a lot of things are going on, but our view is that they progress very slowly. Mm-hmm. And will they progress rapidly enough to change the balance of that equation by 2050, when we'll be roughly 30% of the population? And our answer is we didn't think so. We thought they were moving too slow. Mm-hmm. We started asking ourselves, what can be done to increase the wealth of Latinos in this country at a much faster rate? And so when we asked that question, we said, well, what's the traditional model for getting wealthy in this country? And by and large, it's you go to college, you get an education, you go to work for a company, usually a bigger company, and you rise up near the top and you're wealthy.
Yes.
And you bring wealth in your community. Well, the reality of it is that that equation doesn't work very well for Latinos, as determined by the fact that, less than 5% of C-suite occupants in this country are Latino. Mm-hmm. We have a population of 19%, and less than 5% get up to the tops of those companies or near the top. So it spreads all the way throughout the company. It's not just the top, but, people just don't rise above the first or second level as a group. So that's not working. So we said, well, what else might work? And that's when we started focusing on entrepreneurism. Mm-hmm. And we said, entrepreneurism could be a place where we could help Latinos generate more wealth. And not only could they generate more wealth for themselves, but also for other Latinos, mm-hmm. because their companies tend to hire Latinos more than non-Latinos. Mm-hmm. And so they're contributing jobs, they're creating jobs for the economy.
Anecdotally, here in San Francisco, for instance, I see lots and lots of small businesses which are Latino-owned and Latino, of course, owned, managed, and staffed. And right across the board, in a whole host of not only the restaurant business, construction business, all sorts of businesses, and there seems to be a real entrepreneurial fizz, if you will, in Latino culture, where folks want to create their own business and want to run their own companies and be the masters of their own fate. So is that something that you found?
You're absolutely correct. It seems that Latinos as a culture love to start businesses.
Yes,
the numbers show it. Back in 2002. There were like 1.3 million Latino-owned businesses in this country. Between then and now, the number of Latino-owned businesses has increased a net of around a million new businesses every 5 years.
That's amazing.
So now there are roughly 5.3 million Latino businesses in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So the number of businesses created by Latinos has really been fantastic, outstripping every other community in the country by large margins. So Latinos love to start businesses, which was the good news.
Yes.
The bad news is they stay small. Mm-hmm. 3% of Latino businesses in this country now have revenues of over $1 million, as compared to 9% for white-owned businesses. Mm-hmm. So we said that that's the good news and the bad news. Latinos love to start businesses, but they stay small. So maybe this can point us to the sweet spot of where we ought to head, and that is helping Latinos create larger businesses. What can we do to help increase that percentage from 3% to 9% mm-hmm. Of companies over $1 million. And as we analyzed that, we began to hone in on the notion that, look, the best way to do that is to try to help Latinos create really big businesses, mm-hmm. businesses of $100 million, $500 million, and $1 billion. Mm-hmm. Because the more large businesses you have, the more you do several things. Number one, the more you influence the number of small Latino businesses in providing avenues for them to get bigger, not only through role modeling, but also through doing business with them. In addition, if we ask ourselves, you know, what entity in this country probably exerts the most influence and impact on the day-to-day lives of every individual? You might automatically say, well, it's the government. But that's not totally true in our opinion. We think it's large corporations. It's the largest corporations that hire a lot of people, and in that way, they kind of inculcate them with various values that the organization has, and that shapes them. It's the larger corporations that have lobbyists that lobby the government for laws that benefit them, et cetera, and that shapes the society. So if we look at the way businesses, large businesses shape the society, they have a huge impact. And our view was, hey, that's a reality. Another reality is Latinos don't have any seat at that table. The number of billion-dollar Latino-owned businesses is really small. So we said that ought to be our target, is to help create these very large businesses. We'll not only influence the society in general, but we'll also attract and facilitate the growth of the smaller businesses so that they become larger and scaled, as we call them. Scaled is like a company that's $1 million or over in annual revenues. So that became our focus. We want to create very large businesses. And by the way, our basic purpose as we evolved all of this thinking was that the purpose of what we're doing is to strengthen the United States by improving the lives of Latinos. And the particular avenue we were taking was to increase the number of Latino-owned businesses as an avenue for improving those lives, and then consequently strengthening the country. So we said, oh, these are great ideas. We started getting excited about them. We said, well, how are we going to actually make them happen? And the first thing we decided to do was we needed to create a nonprofit. So we did that. We organized a nonprofit, and we called it the Latino Business Action Network, with emphasis on action. We want to take action. A lot of organizations that have grown up out in the world now, the world of the United States, that focus on varieties of things that are nonprofits, but they don't take as much action as we'd like to take. A lot of them hold conferences and have networking sessions, et cetera, but not a lot of concrete action comes out of that. So we wanted to have concrete action. And that's why we put that word in the title of the nonprofit. So that was the first thing we did. And then we did, after doing that, we said, okay, well, what do we want this nonprofit to do? Specifically, how are we going to impact the wealth of Latinos, and how are we going to help Latinos grow larger businesses? We settled on three pillars. And the three pillars are, first of all, we want to do research.
Right.
Because we want to understand what is the real status of Latino businesses in this country, and what are the barriers to their growth. Now, status is an interesting point, because people have a lot of stereotypical views of Latino businesses. I can walk up to the typical person, and clearly you're not one of those typical people, how you describe the businesses in San Francisco. But I can walk up to a typical person and say, Latino business, and what do you think the first type of business is that is going to come to their mind?
Well, they're landscaping, for instance.
Right.
And, related services. So, yeah
we taquerias. See
taquerias.
Restaurants.
Yes.
Right? House cleaning.
Yes.
Those sorts of activities. Well, the reality is, and our research started to show it once we executed it, is that Latinos are located in all industries in the country in percentages equal to their percentage of the total population.
Oh, that's impressive.
So we're equally represented in all the industries in the country. So we're not just taquerias. We also have high-tech firms. We also have manufacturing operations. We also have consulting organizations or professional organizations. So Latinos are in all industries across the country. And so that was an important idea that we had. The research will help really reduce a lot of stereotypes about what Latino businesses are.
Yes.
And at the same time, research can also point out what are the barriers to their becoming more successful, so that we can begin to influence policymakers, both in government and in corporations, to execute policies that will enhance the opportunities for these businesses to grow and really, really begin to contribute to the society at levels that we're going to need. So our view is that, look, everybody in the country will benefit if we have a very strong and prosperous Latino community. Everybody's going to be better off.
Of course.
If that happens.
The rising tide lifts all ships.
That's precisely the idea. So we said, okay, research is an important first step. What else do we have to do? Now, the research works very slowly, and it works in very uncertain ways. You know, how you get people influenced, government, et cetera, to change their policies. That happens in a variety of ways, and it's fairly vague. It has to kind of filter through the ether in the world out there and get into people's heads and so on. So we say we need to take some more concrete action that's more immediate. So the second thing we want to do, which was the second pillar of our effort, is we want to put on an executive program that will help leaders of companies know or learn some of the ideas around growth, around scaling. So how can we help these businesses scale?
Mm-hmm.
And in determining the businesses we wanted to target, we decided to target those companies that are $1 million already in revenues or greater as the ones that we would allow to enter the program.
Mm-hmm.
And we did this because we thought that would give us the greatest bang for the buck. If you focus on startups in their early stages, huge percentages of them don't ever succeed. They just die.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if you look at the number of startups that fail, it's in the 90% category.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, we've got limited energy and resources, and we want to focus on the place where we can optimize our success the greatest. And that was with $1 million annual revenue companies. So we're going to focus on them, and we want to put on a program that'll help them learn how to scale. Okay, so that was pillar number two.
Mm-hmm.
And then pillar number three was, okay, once we've got the other two things going, we also want to build an ecosystem that will promote the growth and success of Latino businesses. Because the current ecosystem out there is not very helpful to the typical Latino business. And so we think that a lot of things have to be done in that ecosystem to really promote the growth and success of Latino businesses. So those were our three pillars. This is great ideas. We've got these three pillars. But how are we going to execute on them?
Just to reiterate, the three pillars are number one, research. Number two, scale. And number three, an ecosystem which the firm can depend on, can continue to expand into in the community.
To help them to grow.
Help them to grow.
To help them to grow. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the educational part is to help them learn more about how to scale the company, how to make them bigger. So those were the three pillars. We said, okay, how do we actually execute on them? And this is where Stanford came in. All these folks were Stanford MBA, Latino MBA alums, and I had been a professor at Stanford for 40 years. So then the question is, what can we do to make this happen using the resources at Stanford as the way to implement our efforts and make them a reality? So the way universities operate, just to give you some insight on it, is that nothing really of substance happens unless faculty members want it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to have faculty champions for everything. So we created a model then that said, meaning LBAN, will come up with some great ideas about things to do, research, education, ecosystem, and then we'll gather the resources to try to make them happen. But those resources will be gathered in the context of convincing a faculty member at Stanford to champion that effort inside of Stanford.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to do a national survey of 10,000 businesses, 5,000 being Latino and 5,000 being white-owned businesses. We want to do that survey and have an analysis and a report written on it. Is there a Stanford faculty member interested in doing that? And so we found a Stanford faculty member that was interested, and then the cost of that, because it costs a lot of money to survey, you know, roughly $30 a survey, and mm-hmm. you got 10,000, you know, you do the math.
Mm-hmm.
So it's expensive. So we said, okay, how can we do this? And we've got to raise the money to do it. So then we found this faculty member, and the faculty member agreed and set up a mechanism where the cost of the survey were paid for by LBAN. So that was kind of the model we evolved. The second thing is, okay, we want to have an educational program of some sort to teach Latino business leaders how to scale their companies. Well, the executive education group in the business school is there, and that's the part of business school that does that sort of stuff. But faculty member has to drive that. So we found a faculty member who he and another colleague had just recently written a book called Scaling for Excellence.
Mm-hmm.
They converted that book into an online program. So we said, we went and talked to him, and we said, look, we'd love to have you do this program for Latino business owners with some modifications. Would you be willing to do some, you know, allow the modifications to be overlaid on the program so that it becomes very Latino specific? And he was excited about that, said, yes, we'd love to do that. And so we created this online program, which is actually a hybrid program. So that was the design that was added by L-band, which constituted 2 days at Stanford, 7 weeks online, and then a day at Stanford. The 2 days at Stanford and the last day at Stanford was primarily driven by designs that L-band created, in which faculty members from the business school would come and make presentations, but also other things were done to help build a community of these participants. So L-band did that, plus L-band came up with a series of webinars that were held once a week, required attendance throughout the program. And these webinars would focus on specific issues that were related to the scaling problem, but they were very specific to Latinos. And so that was a modification that was added to by L-band. Also, L-band created a network of mentors so that every participant in the program has a mentor, which they have to meet with them once a week for an hour minimum. And this network was created by L-band and does a matching. So the needs of the participant and the skills of the mentor are matched together so that we get optimized that relationship. So those are the sorts of things that L-band has added to the program that was fundamentally coming out of the business school. And that collaboration is what allowed us to create this incredibly successful program. I can tell you about that success in a minute. So that was the second arm, the second platform that we had. The third was ecosystem. Now, in that, Stanford is not playing a really significant role because it's really outside of Stanford,
right?
And it's in the rest of the country. But it's driven to a large degree by what we've been doing with the executive program, with the scaling program. In that, the scaling program runs twice a year. We have about 75 CEOs or COOs of these companies in attendance for each cohort. And we have now run 16. We're in our 16th right now. We have people who have completed the program. The total number is about 1,080. Mm-hmm. And those 1,080 are actively connected with each other on a platform called Mobilize. Mm-hmm. And they're connected with each other, not just kind of for social connection, but for business connection. Mm-hmm. So we preach throughout the program, do business with each other and get business for each other. So one of the things that happens on this platform is just that. Someone says, hey, I need an accountant to come and audit my books. They put that on the platform. Someone else pops up and says, hey, I do that work. Let's get together. And so it happened. Someone during the early stages of the pandemic, someone said, look, I have 1 million pieces of protective clothing, you know, masks and gloves and stuff like that, that I need to ship to the East Coast right away. I can't find a shipper to take it. Anybody help me? Someone in the network who runs a shipping company, a trucking company, pops up and says, hey, let's talk. I can take them for you.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
So that sort of business was being done by people on this network, on this Mobilize network. During the early stages of the pandemic, there was a credible level of confusion around the PPP loans.
Right.
And especially in that first round, people didn't know what to do. And I was, you know, I go on this platform and I look at it pretty much every day to see what's on it. And I noticed that in those early days, someone had posted this pretty much verbatim what I'm saying. I'm dying, he said. I'm dying. I have about 2 weeks worth of cash left to pay for my expenses and for my employees. Mm-hmm. If I don't get a loan within 2 weeks, I'm going out of business. I just don't know what to do. My bank doesn't call me back. I've called them, I've texted them, I've written them, and they don't respond to me. I just don't know what to do. And that's all he said. 2 hours later, someone else popped in and said, hey, I was in your same boat. And then I found out that PayPal was giving out loans within 2 days. I applied to them and I got a loan in 2 days. Hmm. 2 days later, the first guy pops in and says, I just got my PayPal loan.
The power.
We collected data. We did a survey shortly after that period. We did a national survey. And we found out that 18% of all the Latino businesses in the country that applied for PPP loans got them. Mm-hmm. 28% of white-owned businesses that applied for PPP loans got them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. 82% of our alumni who applied for PPP loans got them. And it was to a large degree driven by information that was being shared on this network.
Yes.
I've just given you one example, but stuff was coming out of the government on a daily basis, and we established a connection with SBA, and so stuff came out. It immediately was plugged into our network, and it went out on a daily basis, so people knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. And all of that contributed to this incredible statistic about the success of people getting loans. Mm-hmm. That was the power of the network.
No.
So that's an important component of an ecosystem. In addition, the mentors that we, the mentor network that we created for the program, is a part of the ecosystem also, because those mentorship relationships continue well past the end of the program. And not in every case, but in many cases. Mm-hmm. And so mentors are an important ingredient in an ecosystem that can help you be successful or not. So that's another component. A third component of this ecosystem is access to capital. So one of the things that we do at the very end of the program is we create a capital matching process in which every single one of our participants gets a chance to talk to three different capital providers about providing capital for the growth of their business. Mm-hmm. Well, that capital provider network, we've got somewhere between 75 and 100 different capital providers that are part of that network. They're part of the ecosystem also. So it's building those components of the ecosystem. Also, LBAN has made connections with other organizations throughout the country who are interested in promoting Latino entrepreneurship and business success, like the national, the U.S. Hispanic Business Association. Mm-hmm. It's a national group. So we have connections with that. We have connections with the Latino Donor Collaborative. So there are other organizations that are around that try to promote the success of minority-owned businesses in general, or maybe Latino specifically. And so we create relationships with them too. Mm-hmm. So that's all part of this ecosystem that we're trying to grow as a way of making it possible for Latinos to have the same advantages that the typical white-owned business.
Absolutely. And it sounds as though with these three pillars, the research, the scale, the ecosystem, and you've given a great example of the ecosystem, the different parts of it, the capital raise of it, the availability of loans, that ecosystem is a critical part of the whole program, I would say.
There's no question. That's where the rubber meets the road.
Yes.
You know, we started out and we had a very clear idea about the first two, the research and the education. And we had a vague idea about the ecosystem, but we didn't understand when we started all this. I mean, it's part of our learning process. That's where the rubber meets the road. That's where business gets done. And in the end, that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to promote more successful businesses, and that you get success in business by doing business, right?
Yes.
And getting business. That is really the key place. And our alumni group out of this program has just been fantastic. Mm-hmm. Like I say, there are about 1,080 of them. But that 1,080, about 1,000 of them are active on this mobilized platform, because I can see the number of people who are on it. That's an important way that they're staying connected. They've also, on their own, because LBAN is a small nonprofit, it's only got like 7 or 8 people in it, so it can't really go out and be organizing the alumni very easily. But what happened is that the alumni were so bonded together, not only with the alumni in their cohort, but across cohorts, that they began to spontaneously organize events in their own geographic communities. Mm-hmm. So they start out with dinners and just getting dinners together. So a certain number of alumni in Chicago or in Houston or in Dallas or in Los Angeles or in San Diego or in New York, or, you know, they get together and, mm-hmm. they organize those things. They themselves do it. And then LBAN tries to support it. But they've also started bringing in speakers because they want to continue their growth and their learning. So that these are really active things. And the most successful one that I've heard of happened in Houston about a month ago, in which over 200 people attended.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Now, we do not have 200 alumni in Houston.
Mm-hmm.
So what was happening is that the alumni that were there were generating so much energy that other Latino-owned businesses in the area gravitated to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they put on this dinner and event, they had 200 people show up, or maybe there were only probably 20 or 30 alumni in that area.
And I guess the alumni are also, they capture potential new recruits for the program.
You're absolutely correct. They're our biggest source. About 50% of our applicants every year, every cohort, are recommended by alumni.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they're selling it. And why are they selling it? Because
it works.
It added value to them. Right?
Yes, it works. It works.
It works.
And you know, the way when we began this conversation, and you said that there was a relatively small proportion of Latino businesses that were at the 1 million annual sales level. And of course, you know, anyone who's in business, whatever level you're at, and particularly when you get to $1 million, your next goal is, well, how do I make the next million? How do I make the next 5 million? How do I make the next 10 million? And that, so through this program, the research, the scaling, the ecosystem, you're giving those entrepreneurs, you're giving them the tools and the contacts to make that next million, that next 5 million, a reality. You're actually providing them the building blocks to get to that next million in sales, the next 5 million in sales. Very impressive. I like the emphasis on action, because as you're so right, so many programs that we see these days they're discussion programs. People come together, they're well-meaning, they have great discussions, but there isn't action. What you've done here is all very action-oriented, and it's showing results.
Yep. That's been our guiding force, yep. Action.
In the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts for budding entrepreneurs out there who maybe haven't reached that magic $1 million number, but who are striving towards that? What are your closing thoughts for our listeners today?
Well, I think that it's important for them to continue to focus on their growth, focus on getting bigger. And it can happen. And I know that one of the biggest difficulties with small business owners is they're alone. Mm-hmm. You know, basically, they don't have any sort of support network. So part of I think with the smaller businesses is to try to engage with networks, but engage with them with the perspective that they can, number one, try to contribute to the growth of other people, of other organizations, as well as benefit from their participation in the network. That change in focus, if you will, makes a huge difference in the quality of those networks. And so those small business owners can begin to shape other networks that they're a part of. And I'm saying this really based on the experiences we've had with the network I just described. The vast majority of the people in that network, in our alumni network, are in it because they want to give rather than just get. Mm-hmm. Now, they all want to get at some level, but they're not just in there to get solely. They're in there to also give. Mm-hmm. And we see that so importantly in so many of the experiences we've had, that people reaching out and helping each other to be successful. So being a part of a network, I think, is really important for those smaller businesses. I think also trying to get into educational programs. Unfortunately, if you're too small, you can't get into ours, but there are other ones around. Get into educational programs. It'll help you learn how to scale your company, how to get bigger, how to reach that $1 million level. I think it's an important thing to seek out. So I think it's really useful to not be totally alone in your efforts and your work as the CEO or the owner or founder of a small company, because those networks can help. But don't get involved in networks to just have people that are taking. What can I get out of it?
Right.
Get involved in ones in which people are giving, and you can give too.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jerry, how can our listeners follow you going forward? And what is the website for the entrepreneurship program?
Sure. The website for the program location is kind of in two places. The easiest one is the LBAN website, and it's LBAN.us. But also it's described in the Stanford Business School website. So if you go to the Stanford Business School website, it's then in a portion of it called the SLEI, the Stanford Latino Entrepreneurship Initiative.
I see.
And if you select that area, it'll take you to the information. Now, the program, you don't apply through the Stanford website for the program, but you do apply through the program through the LBAN website.
I see. Okay. Well, Jerry, once again, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. And how can our listeners follow up with you directly? Do you have an X handle? Do you put out a newsletter?
I don't do all of that, but I am reachable through my email, which is porras@stanford.edu.
Well, that's terrific that you're willing to give out your email address like that. Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate that. I know our listeners will treat that with the respect it deserves. Well, once again, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate you coming on the show. I think you've done, this has been a terrific learning experience for me, and more importantly, hopefully for our listeners too. And that idea of once you get to your first million, how do you get to the next million? You've laid out a roadmap here. And listeners, if you haven't, you should probably listen to this episode two or three times. Make sure you share it with your friends, particularly if you're an entrepreneur, because I think there are some great lessons here that Jerry's outlined for you. Again, Jerry, thank you for joining us, and look forward to having you back again real soon.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate your interest.
My pleasure. And for our listeners, today's episode is number 467. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, or any of the 17 platforms that feature the show. Join our listener base that spans 60 countries. FeedSpot has recently recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy coming to you from San Francisco.